So, I almost became ill one time when we were arguing at a parole hearing for James, and a prosecutor, district attorney general, attended, and he went on about how much this nation had lost when Martin King was killed. And I knew the man's roots. But that's what politicians and political figures do, isn't it? That's what we have to learn to understand, yes.
As a close friend of Dr. King, what do you think, if he was around today, his involvement, if any, would be with the current anti-war movement against the war in Iraq? And what do you expect that he'd say to us as citizens, what our duty should be as Americans?
Well, I don't have any doubt if he were around today, he would be very much active in the leadership against the Iraqi adventure. And he would work in every way he possibly could, to stop that war, or to prevent it from happening, or to preempt it, or discontinue it once it started, because he would know what the results will be. And we all should know what the results will be. We're going to once again witness the slaughter of thousands upon thousands of innocents. Before there is ever any military engagement, there will be an engagement of our military with the civilians of Iraq. Once more, an ancient civilization, irrespective of its leadership, an ancient civilization and people is what we're talking about here. The Sumerians, the ancient civilization of Sumeria, 6,000 years ago, had its roots in the southern part of Iraq. Babylon is Iraq. So we're about to destroy not only a people, live, warm, breathing human beings of tender ages, mostly, who are the most vulnerable, but we're going to remake and restructure an ancient civilization's symbols and heritage. Yes.
Was the Freedom of Information Act any help at all to you when you were investigating the case and when you were writing your books?
No. When it comes to the question was, I don't know if you heard the question was, is the Freedom of Information Act any help when we were doing the research? And the answer was no. Freedom of Information Act can be used in a number of matters, and it is possible to use it. But when it comes to very, very sensitive cases and issues like this, it's not useful as far as I'm concerned. Yes.
I think from John Kennedy to Paul Wellstone, we all sort of know on a gut level who and what is behind all this. Do you think it'll ever reach a critical mass to the point where it all comes out and there's really an investigation and the people who are behind it are really taken to task, punished for it?
Not absent a revolution. Mr. Jefferson said you need a revolution every 20 years. Right? And when Jack Kennedy held a meeting in the White House of all the Nobel Prize winners, they had them all for dinner one night. He toasted them and he welcomed them and he said, ladies and gentlemen, never before have so many brilliant minds gathered at this table to dine, except when Mr. Jefferson dined alone. Jefferson, with all of the imperfections that we all carry, believed that you had to cleanse a government and agents and people in power every 20 years, however you have to do that. Well, of course, we have not done that. There's no sign that we're going to do that. Power has consolidated to a point in the United States today where its primary behavioral characteristic is arrogance. And frankly, those are the seeds of destruction of any political system when it gets to that point in time. In my lifetime, the media, the control of the media has become so consolidated that it is it's that's not just frightening, it's something to lament, because there isn't a possibility of getting free and active debate, in this issue. Yes.
When you were a journalist in Vietnam, you mentioned the photographs that were taken. That was the most televised war in history. There were two things that helped the anti-war movement. It was the most televised war in history. You have that classic picture of the little Vietnamese girl naked running in napalm, and all the body bags coming back.
Yes.
Yet during the Persian Gulf War and afterwards, with almost 500,000 Iraqi children dying after we blew up their infrastructure and almost no body bags coming back, and our press had never shown us pictures of the decimation of Baghdad, how do we rally against a war with no body bags and no televised destruction of the civilian population?
What I find very interesting is that throughout the world today, there is building a movement, an anti-war movement of surprising strength with surprising speed. And it's almost happening from the roots of the soils of the of people who know instinctively now what this is all about. It's very difficult to engender this kind of feeling in the United States when the drum beats get louder and louder continually throughout the day, and it's a very difficult task to overcome when you don't have independent media, when transnational corporations control them, bottom lines are important to them. You know, my first book was to have been published by HarperCollins, and they wanted a chapter removed. At the end of the day, everything was clear. They wanted one chapter removed, and it would have made killing a king just a mafia killing. I couldn't do that. Some people still think it might have been better to do it and then come back with it later, but I don't think so. It was too integrated. The forces were too integrated. Yes, the lady back there. Were you asking a question? Oh, okay. Yes.
In your opinion, did he know this was coming? How worried was he for his security?
I'm sorry, can you speak a little louder?
In your opinion, how worried was Martin King for his security? And how much do you think he knew that he was at risk and that this might happen to him?
Well, I mean, you're asking him how prepared he was or how...
To be assassinated.
Yes, he expected he would be killed.
He did. Years before
he was almost killed many years before when he was doing a book signing in Harlem, and a woman stabbed him and it just by a fraction missed an artery that would have killed him. He would have died. But he believed he would be killed. Didn't know when it would come, but he believed he would be killed.
Precautions.
Not enough. Didn't take precautions about being killed, didn't take precautions about wiretapping that was done all the time, because he said, look, I don't mind if they know what they hear what we're saying. We're not doing anything illegal. Let them hear. And what we look at that now and we say, well, how glorious naivete that is, because of course you're not doing anything illegal, but they learn your strategy, your movements, everything about you. This is the enemy you're dealing with here. Right? Well, okay. I don't know how much time they're telling me. I don't have too much time. Huh? Two more. Yes. Yes.
I think after the assassination of JFK, he told Coretta that he was going to be killed. He always knew he was going to be killed somewhere along the line. Mm. But it seemed almost as if he had a special knowledge at that time. He was planning a treat at Gethsemane with Thomas Merton, many things. He was exhausted, depressed. But I think he knew towards the end that this was going to happen.
Well, I think the assassination of Malcolm moved him more. I think that was a very sobering event for him. Okay, one more question. Is there anyone who hasn't asked a question? All right, yeah. All right, well, with you.
You talked about the military unit in the Pentagon. Where did all that start? Was this an autonomous unit? Somebody had to make the decisions and for the orders to go.
Well,
what have you learned about that?
All right, try to understand this. In 1967, 100 cities burned this country. In autumn of 67, the Pentagon was put under siege. There are 200,000 people at the Pentagon, putting it literally under siege. Someone told me that they had a friend who was one of the military aides, and he was up on the parapet of the Pentagon on the day of the demonstration. And there was McNamara and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. No, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs wasn't there. McNamara was there. The chief of staff was there. Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence was there. And down the line came the question, starting with McNamara. What do we do about this? They were terrified. These were barbarians at the gates. And the Chief of Staff shook his head and said, I don't know. Bill, what do we do about this? And he said, Bill said, just give me the go-ahead, and I'll take care of this problem. And I believe that there was a consensus that Martin King had to go. I believe the President of the United States did not know the details of it, but I would be very surprised if he didn't know that it was going to happen, because on the 31st of March, he announced 4 days before the killing that he was not going to run again. So I would have thought this was well known, and I would thought today that there's not much doubt that people in the know in this country understand what it is that's being covered up and why it's being covered up. And particularly now it'll be covered up more than ever, because now more than ever, government lacking credibility for another war needs all the credibility that it can get.
That was William Pepper, author of An Act of State, speaking last month in San Diego, California.
It's all about the price. shit about blood, sweat, tears, and toil. It's all about the price of oil.
Peter Phillips is a professor at Sonoma State University, where he directs the internationally acclaimed media program, Project Censored. Peter was invited to speak in Willits, California, by the Mendocino County Bill of Rights Committee. Now, Peter Phillips on Selling Wars and the New Colonialism.
I got to Sonoma State about 9 years ago, 9.5 years ago, and I'd had 20 years as a social worker over in Sacramento, grew up in Lodi, kind of a farm kid that wanted to change the world, you know, join the war on poverty. I read Michael Harrington's book when I was in high school, and I wanted to go out and save poor people. And worked on the Navajo Reservation, and worked in the barrios in Sacramento, and worked with refugees in Stockton. Midlife, I'd been teaching part-time at Sacramento City College, a bunch of JCs, and I went back to Davis, got a doctorate midlife, and got hired at Sonoma State. It was kind of seemed like the right place at the right time. And Carl Jensen, who had founded Project Censored, was retiring the year I got there. What's been so wonderful is we have over 90 of the faculty and other community people involved that screen the news stories. And we look at thousands of news stories every year. So they're the ones, they're the experts. So if it's a story on nuclear energy, then Lynn Kaminsky, our physicist, is going to read that story and rate it for credibility and national importance. So that's the initial screening process. There's a guy named Bruce Jackson who works in Washington a lot. And Bruce Jackson is the chair of the Committee to Promote the War in Iraq, which was actually formed about 5 months ago. They actively are pushing to have a war. Bruce Jackson also was involved with the plan for the New American Century, which was the right-wing think tank that hosted Wolfowitz, who's now Deputy Director of the Defense Department, Rumsfeld, who runs the Defense Department, William Bennett, used to be Reagan's education czar, Khalilzad, Zalmay Khalilzad. Now, you may recognize that. He's the envoy to Afghanistan, our new colony. These were the people that were working on and writing the plan for the new American century, America in the 21st century. That plan has been published. You can see it on their website. They talk about wanting to increase defense $5 to $10 billion a year. They talk about the U.S. being the global police force, dominating the world militarily, anywhere, land, sea, from space, militarization of space, and control of hyperspace, the internet. Now that's all written down. I mean, it isn't like this is some backroom conspiracy. It's written. It's public. So you don't have to go very far to read what this group has proposed or what the Trilateral Commission proposes or, you know, what the general plans are for the economic elite of the United States and Europe, where they want to go and what they want to do. It's public. It's out there. It's quite aware. Now, who's Bruce Jackson? Bruce Jackson is the vice president of Lockheed Martin, the largest defense contractor in the world. And they stand to make huge profits off of having a war with Iraq. And he was on Clinton's advisory committee. He was actually the main planner for which nations in Europe were going to get to join NATO. So he's been involved with both Democrats and Republicans. We are now the largest supplier of weapons to the world. This is actually one of our stories 4 years ago. We not only make weapons for literally every country, except the evil empire ones, but literally, we're selling weapons to everywhere. The last five times we've gone to war, U.S. soldiers have faced American-made weapons that we've either given or supplied to countries. And it's part of that machine that Eisenhower, of course, warned us about 40 years ago, the military-industrial complex, that has matured to a level that it's really globalized and running the world, or seeking to run the world in a very dangerous way. It's the use of power. Now, there's clearly a conflict still. The French-German ability as the core economic centers for the European Union and the creation of the euro made a strong competitive sense of global trade. Iraq was starting to sell oil for euros and not dollars. Other Middle Eastern countries were considering, and that's, you know, and U.S. is saying, well, wait a minute. The dollar has been the base. The way the dollar dominates in terms of global trade, we've been the base, we've been the economic, we're able to sustain this standard of living, we're able to have deficit spending, we're able to have trade deficits worldwide, because the dollar is the foundation of trade worldwide. That's being threatened. It's being threatened by the euro, and it's being threatened by the yen for a long time. And the part of the core of that, the big flow of dollars, of course, is for oil. So it's not just oil per se to steal the oil from Iraq or capture the oil from Iraq, because Iraq's been selling it to China, to Japan, to Germany, to France. It's a geopolitical move to dominate politically that region for economic control and gain for the U.S. interests. So it's not just about oil. Rumsfeld and his group, Plan America, pushed Clinton to invade Iraq back in 98. Instead, we bombed them a little bit. When the inspectors came out, he was pushing, now's the time to invade. They really lobbied hard. They tried to get us to invade then. When they got in power, immediately after 9/11, and this is in Bob Woodard's book. If you look at, he did that book on the 9/11, trying sort of glorified Bush. But you see the communications that were going on within the Security Council the day after 9/11. Rumsfeld's arguing, says now is the time to invade Iraq. The day after, they didn't even know who had done it. So they wanted to move militarily and occupy that region for a decade. Now, when you think about Afghanistan and whether the Taliban had anything to do with 9/11 or were they harboring the Al-Qaeda, and to what extent the Al-Qaeda really had anything to do with 9/11, they may well have. Putting troops into there really was the goal, to militarily occupy Afghanistan, not only for the pipeline, but regionally. So we've got troops in each of those countries around the Caspian Sea now. Part of it's a buffer relative to Russia and to China, but it's global occupation. We just asked for, you know where Camp Bond Steel is? It's in Kosovo. Now we're going to occupy Kosovo, NATO, U.S. base there now, built by Brown & Root, who's also one of the largest military contractors, is owned by Halliburton, that Cheney used to be the CEO of. Brown & Root is the main supplier. They'll go in and build a military base anywhere in the world. They fly in materials, they put up the buildings, they'll run the commissaries, they'll even supply the outside services outside the gate, whatever the troops need. They're the private subsidiary of Halliburton that profits from war and profits from expansion. Camp Bond Steel now is one of the largest U.S. bases in the world, in the center of Kosovo. They just asked the Yugoslavian government for a 99-year lease. They want to stay there. They want our troops to stay there. And there's nothing going to be temporary about the occupation of Iraq. Now, I was invited by the Popular Fund of Egypt to go to Cairo last month or in December. And there were eight people from the U.S. that went. Sarah Flounders from New York, Elias Rawadi from Davis, Ramsey Clark. And I was really honored. They wanted somebody there to talk about media. And that was, I was able to go, and it was very interesting. I listened for 2 days to speeches, mostly in Arabic, from every Arab country in the Middle East. There was a couple of things that really struck me. I met President Ben Mata. He was the former president of Algeria, very active in the revolution there. And he said, when he found I was American, he said, well, tell the American people that they're the only ones that can stop this war. And I looked and I said, we're marching. This was right after the November marches, and we're struggling. And he just looked, and his eyes were almost glistening, and he said, try harder. And, you know, that's really stayed with me, that we've got to try harder, because we're up against some very powerful forces. I don't like to use the word fascism. You know, if you look at the real definition, it's business power interlocked with government in a monopoly control of the powerful resources and institutions in society. So that's what we're seeing. That's what we're seeing with the manifestation of the Patriot Act, the Homeland Security Act, and now the leaked, Bill Moyers leaked, the Patriot Act II provisions, is the legalization of literally total control. Secret arrests, if you're a citizen. This new Patriot Act II talks about they would really like to be able to, if you were a naturalized citizen, came from another country, and you donated to a group that was supposedly giving to terrorists somewhere, and waiting for Earth First to get labeled a terrorist organization. If you donated to them and you're not a U.S. citizen, or you in some way were affiliated with what was defined as a terrorist organization, you could be stripped of your citizenship and sent back to the country you came from. That's what they're proposing. They're proposing secret arrests without charges and being held for indefinite periods of time for citizens associated with, quote, terrorists. So this is a concern for our civil liberties. And it's a big concern, I think, for all of us when we think about the possibility. They're laying the framework for very centralized control. When the North American Command, when they restructured the military last fall, the North American Command was set up in Colorado Springs. That is now the command center for the United States, all our borders, and all the borders of Canada, and all the borders of Mexico. It's closely interlinked with the new Homeland Security Agency. And so the Coast Guard, military divisions, Department of Transportation, this huge government agency with eliminated unionization rights for the federal workers, eliminated, is being formed in conjunction with the new, you know, North American Command for the military interrelationship. So the Homeland Security clearly authorizes the North American Command to intervene and use any of the 87,000 jurisdictions within the United States who are the first responders, to use them as part of mobilization of forces in any community. So your fire department or your police department can come under in times of an emergency, which are defined by the government, directly under the command of the North American Command structure. I'm not trying to get everybody all paranoid here, because we can resist, and we have inside of us the kinds of beliefs and freedom and rights that we can stand up and say, no, this is not okay. But the communication of these issues is not happening through the corporate media. And that's what Project Censor is about, because we're the ones that find these stories. We list important news stories every year. And those 90 faculty who read the stories and my students, we research them. We use all the databases, LexisNexis, ProQuest, and we find the ones that we think are the most important news stories that the corporate media hasn't covered. And it gets increasingly easy to find stories that the corporate media hasn't covered, especially about areas of the powerful, inside of government, inside of big corporations. Those are the areas that they don't touch anymore. I mean, if a corporate CEO is fooling around or the company goes bankrupt, they can't really ignore that. But they're not investigating. They're not asking the hard questions. Greg Pallas, when he interviewed Dan Rather about 9 months ago, he actually had Dan Rather admit, he said, well, we didn't ask all the questions we should have after 9/11. You know, all the hard questions, you know, and he was almost apologetic for it. But we felt this sense of patriotism. You don't question the government and the president in times of war or in times of, you know, emergency. We have to, you know, kind of go along with and hold the country together kind of thing. And if that's the attitude that we take, and certainly that's the attitude that the corporate media is taking, if that's the attitude we take, then we're going down the wrong road. And we'll all see it, even in our lifetimes. The corporate media has become dependent upon government PR people for news. They're closely interlinked. That is, I mean, they were so close that during the Gulf War, they had psychological operations personnel working at CNN. And then people found out about it, and they said, oh, well, we shouldn't have done that, and they apologized. But, you know, now CNN is training with military units to go along with them, so they're embedded within the journalism is embedded within the command structure to go along, and this is going to give us better reporting. But every field report, Robert Fisk just published this in The Guardian last day or two, every field report that comes from CNN has to be reviewed by an editor here in Atlanta in the U.S. to make sure that it doesn't give away information or it doesn't give the wrong impression of what's happening. So that's the kind of cooperation that CNN is playing with in terms of military interlinks. Now, for them, war is a very profitable business. I mean, if a war's going on and CNN's on the battleships, or it's ABC or CBS, all of them, you know, if they're on the battleships and the cruise missiles are taking off and they're getting the film and they're filming the troops and, you know, and it's electrifying. You know, and it's emotional. You're literally glued to the television. Their ratings go up like crazy. Advertising expenses go up like crazy. I mean, if you think about it, media, corporate media, really is about selling you products. And the real message, Bob McChesney loves to say this all the time, the real message in terms of corporate media is shut up and go shopping. And, I mean, even after 9/11, they were encouraging us, we got to help the economy. Go out and go shopping, right? In San Francisco, they had all the little bags with the American flags on them, and in all the windows, you know, you're patriotic, go shopping. We're now down to 10 big media corporations. 10, that's it. They're in our book. You can see all the little maps. Mark Crispin Miller at NYU does this really great. It was in The Nation last year, but we put it in a book, too. You know, AOL Time Warner now, the largest media company in the world, 64 magazines. I mean, you go into Safeway, and half the magazines there come from one company, 40 record labels. Theme parks, restaurants, corporate interlinks with almost every media system in the world, shared news. ABC and NBC are talking about doing joint news collecting now. Maybe if we get satellite, maybe you get satellite TV and you get 100 stations, or you know, maybe you get cable and cable here and you get all kinds of stations. They're really only coming from 3 or 4 companies. You know, and Neil Postman called us, this was 12, 15 years ago now, the best entertained, least informed society in the world. We know more about the Winona Ryder trial than we know about the impacts of the sanctions on the children in Iraq. Or you have alternative press, independent press will do it. But if you're like most Americans, you get Time Magazine, you watch CNN, you know, and you feel like you're informed. You've been propagandized. Now, there was a turning point, and it really only happened a few years ago. And that was when April Oliver and Jack Smith did the sarin gas story on CNN. And here's two veteran reporters. Jack Smith had been with them for 25, 30 years. And April Oliver was in her fourth. I mean, she'd been doing it for a while, too. And they spent months interviewing officers, Admiral Moore, people on tape, people who were present, people who were not, looking at the story about how the U.S. was using sarin nerve gas in Cambodia during the war in Vietnam. And they were using it in a particular mission where they were hunting down American GIs who deserted to assassinate them. And they had reviewed that story. They showed information that contradicted. You know, they had people on tape that said, yes, it happened, didn't happen. And CNN lawyered it, reviewed it, sat on it for a while before they aired it, thought about it, and said, okay, it looks solid, let's go with it. Those are the highest levels of CNN. So they aired it. They aired this story. And the Pentagon went ballistic. The Pentagon basically, I mean, Colin Powell got involved. Kissinger called up Ted Turner. I mean, they got real serious about it. And they basically told CNN that if you don't retract that story, we're not going to invite you to the next war. Literally. I mean, you're out. So what do? They totally capitulate. They fire April Oliver. They fire Jack Smith. They said, oh, there's errors in the story. They didn't research it good enough. They even tried to slander April Oliver, saying she was an old hippie or something trying to work out her anti-Vietnam phase. She'd never done any of that. I mean, she worked on the Ronald Reagan. Her only political activity was the Ronald Reagan re-election committee. Now, she sued him. And she got a huge settlement. We interviewed her a couple of years ago. And she said, well, I can't tell you how much it was, but I'm living in a brand new house in Virginia, and you'll get an idea that it was substantial. But nobody knows that. And that was kind of that was a turnaround. I mean, we've had other cases before that, you know, Gary Webb at the San Jose Mercury News and the Contra crack connection and the CIA and all the drug dealings and the money going back to the Contras and who knew and who didn't know and the whole bit. And it was clear the CIA was fully aware of it. CIA employees didn't do it. And they had an agreement with the Justice Department. They didn't have to tell anybody if it was for national security. So that came out later. But it was all true. I mean, his book, Dark Alliance, totally documents it all, but Gary lost his job over it. But that wasn't quite the same as the CNN April Oliver thing, which came a few years later. So there was an assertion. in terms of, you know, the political control or statements of the military, from the military, from the Pentagon, even from big corporations to the media, that, you know, if you challenge us in some open way, we'll sue you, we're not going to go along with this. So media, these are big profit-making organizations. They make huge amounts of money. In a presidential election, $2 billion last time was spent in terms of media productions. And this is cheap money because they make the campaigns make they don't even have to produce the slide. I mean, the campaigns make them, and all they do is air them. They get a lot of money for it. So it's the media that's totally opposed to campaign finance reform. It's the National Association of Broadcasters, who is the main lobby group in Washington, D.C., against campaign finance reform. They're totally, you know, it's a profit machine for them. So this interconnected group of top media people, and I say interconnected because the people on their board of directors sit on 15% of the major corporations in the United States, and they sit on each other's boards of directors through shared directorships. They're all interconnected. They all know each other. And it's small enough so that Condoleezza Rice can invite the heads of the television news companies into her office during the Afghan war and say, we really don't want you to cover the civilian casualties very strongly in terms of what's going on in Afghanistan as we bomb them. And they go, okay, we won't. And Isaacson, who was then running CNN, sends a letter down to everybody saying, if you have to cover civilian casualties, like we blew up a wedding party and killed 150 people in a village, and we knew about it, and, you know, it came out because it was all over the foreign press, so we had to cover the story. Try to be sure that you put it in the context of the people who died at the World Trade Center and who were, were doing it, and we're sorry, we didn't mean to kill them. That's the way it came down. So the civilian casualties, which were minimally 3,000 plus in Afghanistan, and that's Mark Harold's numbers, the professor of Vermont, who used multiple sources from foreign press to verify different incidences. He just added them up. He said, at least. I mean, if you drop a 2,000-pound bunker bomb in the middle of a valley, it'll take out the whole town. I mean, if you drop it here, it's going to kill everybody. So, I mean, we dropped a bunch of those in Afghanistan. The media has really abdicated their responsibility. When I say the media, I say the corporate media, has abdicated their responsibility to the First Amendment. Freedom of the press was designed, that, you know, the founders wanted to have freedom of the press so that we would have an informed electorate, so that we could have a democratic process, that we'd know what's going on, that we could explain and have an understanding of the decisions that the powerful people are making that impact our lives. You know, why are wages stagnated for the bottom half of the people in the country? Why are healthcare costs going to the ceiling? And all these other factors that affect our lives, insurance costs, a variety of things. To be able to understand that, to be able to relate to that and make decisions and be able to exercise democratic process. They've abdicated. They're in the entertainment business. They want to keep us watching. They want to keep us shopping. They look for... I mean, we all know about the Peterson, the missing pregnant Peterson wife in Modesto. You know about it in detail. You know, the husband was having an affair. The parents of the family... I don't even know on TV and I know all this. And the parents are upset with him, and then the woman he's having an affair with has kind of jilted him. I mean, you know all of this. It's gossip. Now, it's unfortunate there's a woman missing in Modesto, but 100 years ago you wouldn't even known it. Or it'd be a little, you know, thing in the, even 50 years, it'd be a little thing in the back paper, you know, missing woman in Modesto, suspicious circumstances. Front page news across the country. The woman, what was her name? In Houston, ran over her husband who was a dentist because he was having an affair with this woman. She caught him in the hotel, and they had a fight in the hotel, and she went outside and started ramming her car into the woman's van, and now she just got convicted. We know all about that. And that's the entertainment. That's the gossip. That's the scary stories. All those evil people out there that are going to get us. You know, the reason that, you know, what is it? Over 10 million people in the country live in gated communities. To keep out the bad people. It's fear. It's like living on fear and being afraid of the others out there those different ones, and all these terrible things are happening. We're safer today in the United States per capita than we've ever been in any time in the world. You know, we worry about gangs, and we worry about all this stuff. I mean, Billy the Kid was a 17-year-old with a gun who shot a lot of people. I mean, this has always been, it's always been there. It's always been present. But we've amplified it. We've magnified it so that it's become, you know, we're so worried, you know, become worried and fearful and afraid, and we want somebody to protect us, and guess who's there? The government and the military and, you know, Ridge and Homeland Security, and we'll take care of you. That's the message that comes forward. And we're falling for it. Literally, we're falling for it. And we're afraid to, you know, to do too much. And, you know, the security acts, now they can, we always knew they had Echelon. Echelon, you know, is the spy, and anything that goes through the air, they're monitoring. And they got big computers that look for code words. And we've known this for years. I mean, Project Censored ran this story, gosh, 7 years ago. Echelon was Canada, Great Britain, New Zealand, Australia, and the U.S. spying on the global communication systems and downloading messages and news and all kinds of stuff that was flowing all through the air on the satellites and analyzing it, looking for keywords. Now, the CIA, it was against the law for the CIA to spy on our own people. It's not anymore. You know, now they can do it. Now it's legal. They can pass that information down to your local police service. We've literally, you know, any forms of electronic communication can be monitored at any time. They don't need a search warrant. They don't need anything like that. They're just doing it. Now, there's a private. We had some separation between international spying and the laws. Those are gone. Literally, after 9/11, everything the national security state wanted, they put down. And they got passed through the Homeland Security. So, you know, this whole idea of being able to call somebody a military combatant, a friendly combatant, and to be able to take a U.S. citizen and lock them up indefinitely without trial. Legal foundation apparently going back to World War II has never been done since, but fits very nicely into a state that wants to have that kind of ability to grab any of us at any time. And that's kind of terrifying. So resistors emerge. The anti-globalization movement manifesting itself all over the world to this top-down power. So, you know, we've got environmental regulations, health codes, a variety of things in the U.S., but if you create something higher up called the World Trade Organization and you do treaties that can supersede your laws on your own base, we don't want MBT in our gasoline. We're getting sued by the Canadian company that sells it for restraint of trade. Well, anyway, there's a company in the U.S. that makes, you know, a similar product like MBTE and sells it to Canada. And they sued the Canadian government because the Canadian government didn't want it in their gasoline either. And they won. And so, you know, you get this superseding of local laws. Everybody know Gerber, you know, the little Gerber food, baby food, and has a chubby little baby on it, and you can probably buy it in your local grocery store. Well, Gerber also sells infant formula. And they've been selling infant formula to third world countries. And in Guatemala, they were selling infant formula to peasant women, and, you know, the picture of the chubby little baby, and women said, oh, well, my baby looked like that. And, you know, and so they go mix it with water that's not safe. And the baby gets diarrhea and dies. And Guatemala knew this was happening. And back in the early 90s, they told Gerber, take the little baby off. I mean, you know, you can sell the product, but don't, you know, this is what's really convincing. Peasant women, they can't read this. And they see the chubby little baby, they think it's good for their baby, so they do this, and it causes diarrhea, and the babies die. So we want you to take the little baby off. And Gerber says, no, we won't do it. That's our trademark. So they went to court. A couple, 3-4 years took them, and Guatemala won. And in their own courts, in their own country, Guatemala won, and Gerber was going to have to take off the little baby, you know, the chubby little baby on the label. So they appealed to the new World Trade Organization. And the World Trade Organization said, nope, that is your trademark, that's your right, and they told Guatemala that they would be subject to sanctions and fines from the World Trade Organization if they forced Gerber to take a little baby off. So the chubby little baby is still on the infant formula in Guatemala. So that's the superseding of local democratic process, local democratic involvement by something higher up. something that's more global. Neo-capitalism, neoliberalism, privatization, of corporatization of anything that has value worldwide. And that's really the goal. Not only do we use our military force to maximize that, so that this corporatization process, this globalization process, is in league with the number one military machine in the world. I mean, we spend more on military than the rest of the world put together. So here we are in league. So the capital, the free flow of capital, go anywhere in the world. We don't want any interference. And those evil countries are the ones that interfere with it. Iran, Iraq, Cuba, North Korea, those are the evil ones. Because they don't do business with us the way we want them to do business with us. So if Afghanistan doesn't do business, you invade them. You occupy them, you put somebody in charge. You have Karzai as an envoy. Karzai, you know, worked for UNICAL, was a CIA consultant. So you put a government in power. You can't even find Afghan people who will guard the now president of Afghanistan in Kabul. So you have to hire professional mercenaries from Military Resources, Inc. out of Virginia to guard him. Then you have an economic policy within the country that is favorable to doing business there and building a pipeline and everything else that you want. That's called, the Arabs made this very clear in Cairo, colonialism. It's exactly what it is. You invade a country, you put a government in power that favors what your economic goals, and then you keep troops around, and then you economically exploit the region. That's called colonialism. We've done it for a long time. And the Arabs are saying, hey, you're doing it now, and they think Syria's next, Iran's after that. I mean, that's where we're headed. You know, we're not even sure that the House Assad will be our friends now that we found out that they're the ones that really financed bin Laden. Of course, we knew that all along. It just didn't come out in the corporate media until very recently. And even then, it's only been a little bit. But the French book, Bin Laden, The Forbidden Truth, which was printed in French a year and a half ago, clearly shows that the money trail between the Saudi royals and the bin Laden family to the Al-Qaeda network. It's been going on for years. And that direct link was being followed by the deputy director of the CIA, of the FBI, John O'Neill. And he was in Yemen. They were trying to figure out who blew up the ship there. They were following the money. It was getting closer to the Saudi royals. It was getting closer to the bin Laden family. And the ambassador in Yemen says, back off. She's got orders from the Bush White House. Back off. And he says he doesn't want to. And so he pushes, and he pushes, so they call him back to the country. And when he's here, he goes to a conference in Florida, and his briefcase mysteriously gets missing for 90 minutes. And you may remember this. And this is, I mean, if this had happened to something in an FBI conference, how did the press find out about it? His briefcase was missing for 90 minutes. It has important security information in it, and everybody in the country knew about it the next day. So John O'Neill, he's under investigation. He'd been questioning that the White House was interfering with his investigation into terrorism and the links between the Saudis and the bin Ladens and the Al-Qaeda network and who'd blown up the embassies in Africa. And he's following all the money. He's pushed out. He resigns under protest, goes to work at the World Trade Center as the head of security 2 weeks before September 11th and dies there that day. But he left a record. He said, you know, that the White House was interfering. That's one of our top stories this year, was interfering with his investigation. You haven't seen that anywhere else. You might see it on Michael Rupert's website, and you might see it on, how many know Michael Rupert? A few people, okay. Cop versus CIA. He's a little conspiracy-oriented, but has some good stuff. Our news doesn't tell us those stories. Thomas Nagy was a professor back east, was with me in Cairo, had won one of our awards last year, story number 5 in our book. He used the Freedom of Information Act. It took him years to secure the documents from the defense intelligence agencies that proved that the United States deliberately targeted the Iraqi water sanitation plants and purification plants in all their cities. We deliberately blew them up, which was, of course, a violation of the Geneva Convention, which says you don't destroy the infrastructure, civilian infrastructure. Deliberately blew them up. We knew what the impacts were going to be. The water, the Typhus Euphrates, the pollutant is not safe. I mean, you can't get pure water to the people. It's not safe. Tens of thousands of children and seniors, the weakest, have died from waterborne diseases since. Tens of thousands. We forbid chlorine to be imported into the country because it was considered dual use. So they did build some of their own chlorine factories. They've been getting back online. The water's a bit safer now in some of the main cities. They had a heck of a time, and they lost a lot of children and a lot of people because of waterborne diseases in that time period. The head of the Food for Oil program through the UN was Dennis Halliday, and he had been a 25, 30-year veteran with the United Nations, deputy director, deputy secretary. He was in charge of that, and he had been to Iraq. He was in charge of the exchange, the money. Iraq was get to sell oil. For that, they could use it to buy special articles. Part of the money of the oil that they were selling was going to repay oil companies for the damages from the war, and to repay Kuwait for the damages there. But the money was coming back in. And when Amy Goodman was interviewing Bill Clinton, and she asked him about that. Remember when Bill Clinton didn't, how many heard that? A lot of us heard that, didn't they? Clinton calls up and he's trying to promote Hillary's, you know, campaign, and she just nails, gets into him. And he was saying, it's Saddam Hussein who's killing his own people. He's keeping that money. He's building his palaces. He's the one what's doing that. Well, Dennis Halliday, who in 98 resigned from, he could no longer stomach being head of the Food for Oil program for the UN, he resigned in protest. He's been speaking all over the world about this. Dr. von Spaket, Dutchman, who took over, stayed about 18 months, and then he resigned. I met both of them in Cairo. Had dinner with them. We talked about it. They're saying the Iraqi people under the Food for Oil program were asked to live on $174 per year per person. I mean, we spend more than that on soda pop, on average. And that was what they were expected to live on. So Iraq, as a country, had gone from being the highest standard of living in the Middle East to one of the lowest standard of living countries in the world, on par with Bangladesh. And those sanctions have had that kind of impact and I'm not in any way defending Saddam Hussein, but you know, we're talking about an invasion that's not just to get him. This will kill tens of thousands of families, civilians, soldiers who were conscripted. It'll be a humanitarian disaster. We can't let that happen. We've got to, as President Ben-Bella said, we've got to try harder to do what we can do. You sometimes just wonder, what can we do? How can we resist? Just every way possible. We can build our own grassroots media. And it's happening. All those people in Seattle, that big march, you know, the globalization, that was the first indie media center that got formed. Activists with computers and video cameras and radio tapes and typewriters, computers, putting it all on a website, live from the streets of Seattle. And you can go to Indie Media, indymedia.org, and see what was happening in Seattle at that time. And 1.5 million people in the world did in the first 24 hours. And it was totally different than what CNN was showing. And actually, CNN actually had to change. They had to start including, because this was so obvious, with such an impact. There's 105 indie media centers in the world today, all interconnected. You can go to Indie Media Chiapas. You can go to Indie Media Brazil. You can go to Indie Media Naples. I was there a year ago. Met those kids. They're great. They were putting together. They have an indie media site doing stories. You know, they were saying Buscaglione doesn't like this. Buscaglione doesn't like this. They're going to come and get us. Rome too. And a month later, all their equipment, all their stations were torn down and the equipment confiscated. They're back up. They're back up online. But it was impacting. I mean, they were having an impact. It was showing. But right now we have that ability to talk to each other. 2 weeks ago, starting in Fiji Island, all the way around the world, demonstrations, every country, Australia, New Zealand, all the Arab countries, India, all over Europe, 60 cities in Spain, millions of people in Rome, Naples, Germany, London, New York, San Francisco the next day, 12 million plus, maybe 30 million worldwide. the largest coordinated demonstration ever in the world. And Bush calls it a focus group? We can't stop. We just got to keep going. There's a National Advisory Committee of all the top communication people in the country that was formed by Reagan, actually, in the 80s, to set up to make sure that subversive materials are able to be blocked if we need it to. So in a time of crisis, I think the Internet will be not available to us for very long, which means we have to have our own means of communication and our own ways. The Internet's there. We can share things. When I was in Cairo, I met the young people from the university there that were running a website called Islam Today. It's in English. And, you know, so we've got a huge amount of stuff. So to find news stories on a local basis and put together a newspaper is relatively easy. We've pre-sold 500 subscriptions to get enough money to start with. And we have fundraising dinners, and we've got about 1,300 subscribers today. And we made it through our first year. We were doing twice a month, and we kind of burned ourselves out, so we're now doing once a month now. But, we made it, and we're going to keep going. It can be done. So you can do your own newspaper, but radio, cable access television, you ask television. I mean, yeah. I mean, don't watch the corporate media. I mean, you don't need it. I have not owned television in 14 years. And I'm sure a lot of you don't. Increasingly, the polls are showing us that people are turning away from newspapers and watching television for news, increasingly. So what they're doing is they're hypering it up. More gruesome murders, more scary stories. I mean, they're jacking this up. And I think that there's certainly people that know. I mean, certainly people that are writing. Ben Bakdikian, McChesney, Solomon, a lot of people are writing. And who are in media, a variety of levels, even Walter Cronkite, we interviewed him in our book 2 years ago, saying we can't keep doing this. We have to get back to, real news that reaches people on a local level. I don't think we're going to get politically to be able to stop Michael Powell and the FCC from allowing even further consolidation. I'm part of that movement. There's the resistance. There's, speakers, and they may not be able to do as fast as they'd like it to be. So Clear Channel, instead of being able to buy half of the radio stations in the country, only owns a third of them now, but they'd like to go to half or even more, and Infinity Radio. But maybe they'll have to be a little bit slower at that than they are. We've got to keep, independent media alive. Now, the other question, the macro question you ask, is what do we do about all this stuff? We do whatever we can do wherever we are. So they've got nowhere to go but to get tighter and tighter with what they're doing. And we've got nowhere to go except building our own and just undermining them. We get a 5% market share, we'll see some change. I mean, literally. I mean, that's if we can get 5% of the people reading only independent news and getting all their news from KPFA and Pacifica and just not paying attention anymore, it'll see some change. We're going to have to do it on our own backs with our own nickels. During the American Revolution, only 10% of the people back Washington were actively engaged. Just 10% of the people. 10% of the people actively sided with the British, and 80% sat around and see which way it was going to go. So, 5 and 10% can be a huge number in terms of a social revolution.
I've been listening to Peter Phillips, director of Project Censored at Sonoma State University, speaking last month in Willits, California. For more info on Project Censored, visit www.projectcensored.org. Thanks to Dan Roberts for that tape and to Billy Bragg for his music, The Price of Oil, and our theme song, Unwelcome Guest, performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. And if you'd like to foster the growth of independent media here in the Finger Lakes, please support Ithaca Community Radio. To find out how you can contribute, visit the website at www.ithacaradio.org.